holding hands and my dad was crying. I'd never seen him cry before. Then they said, cancer. Just cancer, as if that explained everything.
I can't imagine explaining that to a child.
Neither could they, I guess. Dad told us Mom would need more help around the place, so Stephen and I cleaned it up pronto that first afternoon. We actually tried to clean the bathrooms for the first time as a surprise. For the record, hand soap doesn't clean stainless steel very well. Then you should have seen us with the vacuum cleaner. Oh boy.
Made a mess?
Sucked up half the drapes. Who would have thought?
Melanie smiled. It was sweet, though. Both of you trying.
Yeah. Mom went to chemo. We stripped the kitchen floors. Radiation treatment started, we did the windows. She relapsed, we shampooed the rugs. People in the neighborhood were always dropping by with casseroles, pot roasts, you know. Because surely with the little wife feeling blue, the husband and sons would starve. They'd comment on how great the house looked, how great Stephen and I looked, what brave little troopers we must be. My mom went back to the hospital. We stripped beds and soaped down furniture and beat out drapes and polished silver, and she came home. She came home and lay down in our perfectly spotless living room and died. Because that's what cancer does. It kills you. Even when you have perfect little boys and a perfect loving husband doing everything they know how to do to keep you alive.
I'm sorry, she whispered. He shrugged awkwardly. His voice had broken more bitterly than he'd intended. He couldn't find a good flippant retort to break the mood. He never thought about this stuff. He just didn't. Now he felt overexposed. He untangled Melanie from his lap, climbed off the chair, and put some space between them. He could tell she was a little hurt, but he couldn't find it in himself to go back.
It's not easy to talk about it, he said.
I know.
I just, need some space.
David, I know.
Jesus Christ, how much bad luck can one fucking family have?
Melanie didn't say anything this time, and he exhaled in one angry rush. Time to get a grip, Riggs. Time to pull it together. He settled his hands on his hips and looked around.
It's getting late, Melanie. What do you say?
Yeah, I guess it is time for bed. She suddenly flushed. I mean, to sleep. In our own rooms, in our own beds.
You take the loft. I should be close to the door.
You really will be gone all day?
I have to go to this meeting. My boss is a little excited about me firing my gun. In contrast to what you might think, it doesn't happen every day, particularly when you work fraud.
You did well, she said, looking impressed. Got me out? Wounded the guy? David grimaced.
After all the times I've fired at paper, I should have put it where it counted.
He was a human being, David, not paper.
Well, we'll see if we both still think that when he comes around again. I'll try not to be in the office too long. Why don't you sleep in, order up a big breakfast, take a day to relax and catch your breath again?
Maybe, she said at last. Then, I should call my mother.
No.
Yes. I can't just stay out all night without even a phone call. You have no idea how much she worries. David gave her a look.
Don't tell her what's really going on. Until we know who is involved and why, it's too dangerous. Got it?
I'll say I'm spending the night at a friend's.
Don't go into details. Details will only get you into trouble.
So says the master, Melanie muttered. She turned toward the stairs. The minute she saw shadows gathering upstairs, her shoulders sagged.
Why don't I leave the lights on?
He said. It's okay. I'm a grown woman. I know better than to be afraid of the dark.
Yeah, but I'm an FBI agent. And frankly, we're all a bunch of wusses. There isn't an agent alive who doesn't sleep with the light on. I swear.
She smiled. It was filled with just enough gratitude to tighten his chest. Thank you, she whispered. Melanie climbed upstairs. David watched her feeling the cold water trickle down his back as the cauliflower melted into his jeans. He turned on his computer, fetched the fax sent by Cheney earlier in the evening,
started poring over a 25-year-old case file, courtesy of the Houston police. His back throbbed, his eyes blurred with exhaustion. He made some instant coffee and kept going.
"I'm gonna get you," he muttered. "Whoever you are. After what you did to little Megan, I'm gonna get you good."
17. Patricia was asleep when the phone rang. In her dreams, she was Miss Texas again, walking the runway with her Vaseline smile and beaded gown. "Look at me, look at me, look at me." And they did. The men roared their approval, the women cried to see such beauty. She had captured the hearts of her home state. She had made her father proud, and as they placed the diamond tiara on her head, she wished it would last forever. Fairy tales should never end. She walked backstage, and Jamie O'Donnell wrapped his arms around her.
"Beautiful lass, beautiful lass,"
she giggled and kissed him passionately. She looked beyond his shoulders and saw her daughter's headless body.
"Bad mommy, bad mommy, bad mommy!"
Patricia jolted awake with a scream. Blackness, thick blackness. The phone rang for the second time and she fumbled for it. She could read the clock now, just after midnight. Harper was still not home. She put the phone to her ear.
"Mom?"
Patricia was so disoriented she almost screamed again.
"It's Melanie,"
the voice continued, and Patricia, rattled beyond words, just nodded. Then she gripped the phone tighter and commanded herself to pull it together for her second daughter.
"Yes, Melanie, love. Where are you calling from? It's after midnight. Are you all right?"
There was a pause. Too long a pause. Patricia felt the first whisper of unease.
"Honey, is everything all right?"
"Did you find a note, too? Did someone slip into your locked car? Threaten you, snatch you, kill you?"
"Oh, God, please, baby, tell me you're all right. I swear I never meant—"
"I've just had a long day," Melanie said. "I met up with a friend. We went to a few bars. I'm going to stay here for the night." Patricia frowned. Her daughter never did things like meet an anonymous friend for drinks and then spend the night.
"Are you sure you're all right? I can come get you. It's no bother, really."
"I'm fine."
"Are you having another migraine? Your father and I have been worried about you."
"You have?" She sounded genuinely surprised.
"Of course. Melanie, I don't know what's going on. You're calling in the middle of the night, and you don't sound like yourself. Please, sweetheart, if you need to talk, if you've done something and now you need a shoulder to cry on."
Her voice ending pleadingly. Maybe desperately. Suddenly she had that same tightness in her chest she'd gotten the day she'd come home to police cars surrounding her house, and a man she'd never met before calmly telling her they were doing everything they could to find her daughter.
"Melanie,"
she whispered. "Do you remember the first day you came to the hospice?" her daughter asked suddenly.
"Do you remember the first time you saw me?" "Of course I do. Why?" "When I looked at you, Mom, I remember thinking you were so beautiful, so lovely. I desperately wanted to be your little girl. I don't even know why, I just did. What did you think when you looked at me?"
I remember being very impressed, Melanie. You were such a small child, abandoned, no name, no memories. You should have been terrified, but you weren't. You smiled bravely. You told little jokes and made other people laugh. You looked strong, Melanie. You looked like everything I'd always wanted to be. But why adopt me?
Had you and Dad spoken about adopting a child before?"
"Well, no." "Then why change?"
Melanie's voice had gained urgency. "Why suddenly adopt a 9-year-old girl?"
I don't know. It was like you said, I suppose. The minute I saw you, I wanted you too.
Why, Mom? Why?
I don't know.
Yes, you do, damn it. I want to hear it. Why me?"
"It doesn't matter."
"Yes, it does. You know it does.
Tell me.
Tell me right now, why did you adopt me?"
"Because you looked like Megan, all right?
Are you happy?"
"Because when I saw you, I thought of Megan, and then I had to have you.
I just had to have you.
Patricia broke off. She realized what she had said. The silence on the other end confirmed it. Oh, God, what had she done?
Megan,
her daughter said quietly.
You looked at me and you saw Megan.
No, I didn't mean that, Melanie, please. You confused me. You badgered me. She didn't seem to have heard her. I got a family because I looked like a murdered little girl. The house, your love. All along, you just wanted Megan back. No, Patricia cried. No, that's not what I meant. Yes, it is, Mom. Finally, we are getting to the truth. Why is it so hard in our family to get to the truth? Melanie, love, listen to me. I am human. In the beginning, maybe I was confused. Maybe I did see what I wanted to see. I know you are not Megan. Remember when I dressed you up in those lacy dresses and did your hair? Remember what that did to you? And I saw it, Melanie. I realized how much I was hurting you, and I let it go. I realized I wasn't looking for Megan after all. She was gone, but through God's good graces, I had gotten another little girl. A different little girl. Melanie Stokes, who likes used clothes and garage sale furniture. And I discovered I genuinely loved Melanie Stokes. You healed me, honey. You are the best thing that ever happened to me, and I swear to you, Melanie, your life has not been a lie. I love you, I do. There was no answer, just more chilling silence that signaled her daughter's doubt, her daughter's hurt. Patricia closed her eyes. A tear trickled down her cheek. She didn't wipe it away.
Melanie,
she whispered.
Did you really love Megan? Oh, heavens, child, more than my own life.
More silence.
I have to go now. Melanie, I love you too.
Good night, Mom.
Melanie, good night.
The phone clicked. Patricia was alone in the darkness. She thought of those warm, sunny days in Texas with the first daughter she had loved so much. She thought of the note in her car. She thought of her son, no longer speaking to his father. She thought of Jamie O'Donnell and all the sins that never could be undone. She whispered,
"No more, Lord. This family has paid enough."
Dr. William Sheffield slept on the empty hospital bed, the way he'd learned when he was an intern. Then the hand on his watch hit 3 a.m., and the tiny bell began to chime. He sat up smoothly, going from deep slumber to instant wakefulness, the way only a doctor can. He felt a faint hammering in the back of his skull. The whiskey, of course. He'd brought a pint into the hospital with him earlier, finding a back room and spending hours bolstering his courage, fingering the gun he now wore beneath his white lab coat. He wasn't thinking of what he'd found in his house last night. Piles of healthy pink organs and a shiny red apple on his bed. And on his bathroom mirror, the words, "You get what you deserve," scrawled in blood. The whiskey warmth had carried him to a special place, where he was the golden boy, the perfect anesthesiologist, the man who always won at the roulette table with his lucky number 8.
"Just a few more," Harper had repeated earlier in the day.
"It's too risky," William had insisted. "Nonsense," Harper had said briskly, but William could tell he was scared too. The last few days, calm, controlled Harper Stokes hadn't seemed so calm or controlled. William had even caught him glancing over his shoulder from time to time, as if he expected to find something bad behind him.
"3 more tops," Harper had finally said. "You can handle it, William. Your credit card debts will be clear, and you can start over. Clean slate. Still making over $500,000 as an anesthesiologist. As long as you don't resume gambling, you should be able to live a very good life, without anyone being hurt or anyone being the wiser. That's what you've always wanted, isn't it?"
That was what William had always wanted. The fancy house, the fancy car, the fancy clothes. Every symbol of success dripping from his wrists, his feet, his body. So William had agreed. He'd had his whiskey, and an hour earlier he'd walked into the ICU. And in plain sight of God and everyone, he'd injected a vial of propranolol into the candidate. Now he dug into the pocket of his lab jacket and fingered the second needle, He stepped out into the hall. At 3 in the morning, the hospital had adopted a quiet, somber state. Lights were dimmed for patients. The nurses talked softer. Machines pulsed rhythmically. There was no one in the halls as William slipped into the ICU. The candidate had been admitted that morning. That's how William categorized them in his mind. Candidates. Tonight's candidate was a 65-year-old male. Healthy. Active. History of heart disease in the family. He'd watched his father drop dead of a heart attack at 50. So at the first signs of chest pains, the man had dialed 911 and hopped a ride to the ER. He'd gone through the whole medical process, including a fluoroscopy, which had revealed he didn't have any blocked arteries. Now he was drugged in the ICU to keep himself from pulling out the catheter. His heart monitor looked good. They still weren't detecting any dangerous cardiac enzymes, and most likely he'd be released in the morning, none the worse for the wear. Except an hour ago, Dr. William Sheffield had injected him with the beta blocker propranolol, causing temporary heart failure that had been reversed only by the nurse administering 0.5 milligrams of atropine. That had been round one. Now it was time for round two, and the overworked nurse was once again out of the room, checking on someone else. It was the fault of budget cuts, William thought dully. The fault of stupid nurses who didn't protect their charges from people like him. The fault of paranoid candidates who thought they could still eat pepperoni pizzas and garlic bread without repercussions. The fault of everyone else but him. He was just a lonely, abandoned kid trying to make his way in the world. The rest of them should know better. William grabbed the T-injection port on the IV and stuck in the second needle. The candidate's heart rate plunged to below 30 beats per minute, and the heart monitor screeched red alert. William hightailed it for the door. He was just about to pass through when he spotted the nurse racing down the hall, a second just coming around the corner behind her. Shit. They would see him. How to explain leaving the room, what to do. Hide. William dropped to the floor and rolled beneath a pile of soiled sheets just as one of the nurses rushed into the room. Come on, Harry, come on, the nurse was saying. Don't you do this to me again. The second nurse arrived on the scene. I got a pulse. He's still breathing. What's the blood pressure? The rasping sound of the blood pressure cuff. The nurse cursed at the reading while the blood monitor alarm still screeched because Harry's heart refused to speed up. We need atropine, the first nurse declared. Second time tonight. Come on, Harry. What are you trying to do to us? We like you here, I swear it. She rushed out, then returned moments later. William heard her tap the needle to remove air pockets. The atropine, he guessed. Please, please, don't let her drop the needle and bend down to pick it up. Come on, come on, come on, the first nurse muttered. Abruptly, the beeping stopped. The atropine had successfully stimulated the heart rate back to normal. Well, he's stable for now, the first nurse said with a sigh. Have you called Dr. Carson Miller? Not yet, but I'll give her a buzz now. This is Harry's second attack in just 3 hours. That's not good. Anything you need me to do? No, I'm all set. Thanks, Sally. Anytime. M&M's at 4, right? Wouldn't miss it for the world. Sally exited. The first nurse picked up the phone and called the on-duty cardiologist. Once again, everything proceeded as planned. Harper had explained it to him 2 years ago.
What is the weakness of a hospital? The fact that it's all routine. Each crisis has a process. Everything we do is planned and predictable. In the end, medicine is much more cookie-cutter than doctors care to admit, and we can exploit that.
He's gone bradycardic twice now, the nurse was explaining to Dr. Carson Miller, no doubt having woken her up from her sleep in another empty hospital room. I've administered atropine both times to restore rhythm. William knew the cardiologist's response.
Twice, huh? Keep Harry NPO. We'll have his doctor check him out again in the morning and bring in Dr. Stokes for a consult. Glance at his day, all right? Good night.
The phone clicked. William managed to breathe again. Everything was done. He still felt hysterical, but wasn't sure why. After all, it went just like all of them went. Smooth as glass. Inject twice, giving the candidate 2 bradycardic episodes. Cardiologist does the sensible thing and recommends the installation of a pacemaker to regulate the heart. Dr. Harper Stokes agrees, and it's done. Why wouldn't the nurse leave now? William needed her to leave now. He heard footsteps. Loud, ringing footsteps coming down the hall. Men's shoes appeared in view. Brown suede Italian loafers.
I'm sorry, sir, the nurse said immediately. But you can't just walk into the ICU.
The man said.
I know. This is for family only.
During visiting hours, the nurse said firmly. These aren't visiting hours.
Yes, I know, but I'm with the FBI.
William bit his lower lip.
I'm a friend of this guy. I mean, he's an old friend of the family. I understand he had some chest pains today and was rushed to the ER. We'd heard it was nothing, but then I found out he was in the ICU. I promised my pop I'd check in on him. Of course, my job doesn't let me come during normal hours. I was just gonna glance in, but the lady at the desk said he'd been having problems. Can't you at least tell me what's happening?
The man was lying, of course. Even a 4-year-old could tell the man was full of shit. FBI agent appearing in the hospital at 3 a.m. to look in on a friend. And then William understood. That's what the note had said. You get what you deserve. And the organs, of course. The organs were a symbol of what he and Harper were doing. Someone knew. Someone had sent the agent for him. At any minute, the agent would make a pretense of dropping his gun, bend down and shoot William. You've been a bad boy. A very bad boy. Bad Billy. Oh, dear, the nurse said. You really can't be in here. I'll have to ask you to step outside.
But is he all right?
Mr. Bower has had a rough night, I'm afraid. Most likely he'll have surgery in the morning, but his doctor can tell you more about that.
He needs open-heart surgery?
The man sounded both stricken and triumphant.
Well, he might. Please, nurse, tell me exactly what happened.
The feet started moving. The nurse was ushering the man to the door, but she was also beginning to explain. William lay transfixed. You get what you deserve. Slowly, he reached beneath his arm and pulled out his gun. He took off the safety. He was ready, he promised himself. He wasn't some scared, spineless kid anymore. He'd learned a lot growing up as an undersized boy in a Texas orphanage. Time to start thinking, William. Time to take control. You get what you deserve. William made his decision. If that's the way this thing was going to be played, he'd play it. Dr. Harper Stokes might think of William as harmless, maybe even a fall guy. But Dr. Stokes hadn't seen nothing yet. 18. In a dark suite of the Four Seasons, just across from the public garden, just across from the Stokes' Beacon Street townhouse, Jamie O'Donnell sat on a blue velvet sofa, brandy snifter in one hand, TV remote in another. An old goat like him shouldn't be surfing the channels with the lights out. He should turn off the TV, go to bed, snuggle up with Annie and savor the soft sound of her breathing. Beautiful woman, Annie. The best thing that had ever happened to him. He remained in front of the TV, flipping the channels. In many ways, Jamie considered himself a simple man. He'd worked hard all his life, fighting his way up from poverty tooth and nail. He'd killed men and he'd seen them die. He'd done things he was proud of, and he'd done things he knew better than to think about late at night. You did what you had to. He'd arrived in Texas at the ripe old age of 13. He started working the oil fields when he was just 14. By the time he was 20, he'd developed the broad shoulders and the thick neck of a day laborer. His face was generally stained black, his nails too. Definitely not a pretty boy, but he'd never let it get in his way. Come sunset, Jamie was always the first person off the fields, into the showers, and then into town. College campuses, that's where he liked to go. College campuses where he could dream. And that's where he'd met Harper Stokes. Introduced by mutual friends, they'd sized each other up immediately. Shrewd Harper had recognized that Jamie didn't fit in. No way was this thick, dark man a student. In turn, Jamie had known that Harper didn't fit in. No way was this thin, overdressed Poindexter really an aristocrat. They were the outsiders, and they both knew it. So they spent the next few months competing against each other to see who would break into the golden clique of old money. They schemed against each other and ridiculed each other, and somehow along the way, they ended up friends. Harper liked to talk of money even back then. He was obsessed with what other boys wore, what other boys drove. Jamie understood. He'd spent enough time in the oil fields to know he wanted to be someone someday too. Harper lectured him nonstop about the power of education, the proper way to talk and dress. Jamie figured he might have a point. He cleaned up a little. Then he taught Harper how to throw a proper right hook. Now that was something every man ought to know. And then on Friday nights, the mutual education delved into deeper grounds. Bookish Harper, desperate for the perfect upper-class wife, couldn't even get a date. Jamie, on the other hand, went through women by the dozen. He adored them, and they sure as hell adored him. So every now and then, he'd try to send one Harper's way. It seemed the least he could do. Then Patricia walked into both their lives. Ironic that the things men would do for love could be so much worse than the things they'd do out of hate. Life worked itself out. Jamie knew that now. In many ways, he and his old friend had gotten exactly what they wanted. Harper lived in a Boston townhouse. He had his showcase wife, his golden children, his glowing reputation. No third-generation blue blood would question the great Dr. Stokes these days. And Jamie couldn't complain either. He jetted around the globe, he built a business empire. He stayed in all the right places, met with all the right people. Sure, not all his friends belonged in polite society, but he had power now. No one was getting rich off his sweat but him. Two old men, so many years the wiser. Perhaps when all was said and done, the biggest lesson of all was that familiarity did breed contempt. 1 hour earlier, Harper had called him on the phone, rousing him from a slumber. Harper's voice had been too calm, his anger too quiet.
"What are you doing, O'Donnell? It's been 25 years. I've kept my end of the bargain, and we are much too old for this shit."
Jamie had yawned.
"Harper, it's 2 in the morning. I don't know what you're talking about, and I don't feel like playing guessing games. The note in my car, damn it. This little vendetta against William. Breaking into his house to plant a pile of pig organs. Classy, O'Donnell. Just plain classy."
"Someone left a pile of pig organs in William's house."
Jamie laughed.
"Did the poor boy get sick? I bet he did. I would have paid to see that, you know. I've always hated that spineless booger." "Oh, cut the crap. I want to know why you're doing this. Damn it, we all have too much to lose."
"You got it all wrong, sport. I don't know what the hell is going on or who the hell is doing it, but as of tonight, I also joined the club."
"What?" "I got a present, too. And delivered to the concierge downstairs. Wrapped nicely, I have to say. The ribbons even made those pretty little curlicues. You'd like it, Hap, you would."
"What was it?"
Harper sounded perplexed. He'd never liked the unexpected, and it was stealing his headwind of righteous rage.
"I got a canning jar, and floating in it, in some kind of shit I just don't want to know, is a cock and balls. A penis. A pickled penis."
There was a moment of horrified silence. Then Harper laughed. Then his voice grew cold.
"A castrated penis. How charming. Tell me, Jamie, do you still dream about her? Do you still lust after my wife?"
"For God's sake, Hap, I'm telling you again, I'm not the one responsible for what's going on. It's been decades, man. I've moved on."
"Ah, decades, of course. I suppose even beauty queens don't look quite the same after 30 years. You're an idiot, Harper. That's what you'd like to think. But I'm the one who won the girl in the end, aren't I? And I know that still galls you, O'Donnell. You just can't handle that you've never understood Pat any more than you've understood me. Hap, you're missing the point."
"What point?"
"Somebody knows, Harper. After all these years, somebody knows about Megan."
Harper shut up. He turned his attention to business, and together they ran through the facts. It wasn't encouraging. Harper had received a note, William had gotten a pile of organs and a note, and Jamie now had a pickled penis. Plus, there were the hang-ups Annie had been receiving. Finally, Larry Digger was in town after all these years.
"It could be him,"
Jamie said after a moment.
"He doesn't have the imagination. Never did." "What about Patricia? Has she received anything?"
"Hasn't said a word to me."
she wouldn't say anything, Harper. At least not to you.
Harper didn't argue the point. No matter what he liked to say, his marriage had fallen a long way from being a love match over the years, and they both knew it.
She'd tell Brian, though,
he said at last.
And Brian would be angry enough to tell me. Even though, I think you know as well as I do, O'Donnell, that my own son hates me more than ever. I would think that would make you happy. No,
Jamie said honestly.
It doesn't.
Harper cleared his throat. He was shaken up about his son, handling it badly in Jamie's opinion, but genuinely shaken up. That made Jamie feel something he wasn't prepared to feel after all these years. Pity. Sometimes he hated Harper Stokes. He saw all the things Harper did that his family knew nothing about, and at those times he thought Harper Stokes could very well be the devil. Then there were moments when he confused even Jamie. Harper did seem to love his son. He had been honestly betrayed by Brian's little announcement.
Melanie's migraine, Harper suddenly said.
What about it?
I assumed it was due to stress. But what if it's not? Melanie hasn't had a migraine in 10 years, not even when she split with William. So why now? Unless it's more than just stress. Unless it's her memories.
It could be. It could be.
Jamie couldn't say anything more. He could tell Harper was equally spooked. Her memory was the wild card, the one thing that could undo it all. In the beginning, they'd obsessed about it constantly. But after 25 years, all of them, he supposed, had grown comfortable.
The truth has a life of its own,
Jamie said at last.
Maybe the only real surprise is that it took it this long to find us again.
Who the hell could be doing this?
Harper exploded.
I don't know.
What about you? Or maybe Brian?
What would we possibly have to gain, old man? How could we come out ahead? Melanie would hate our guts, and maybe you don't care, but I know I do. And I'm sure as holy hell that Brian does.
It's too late, O'Donnell. All of us have gained too much to lose it all now. I'm taking the family to Europe, that's it.
Europe?
Oh, I didn't tell you.
Harper's voice grew innocent, and Jamie knew his old friend was moving in for the kill.
I asked Pat this morning. We're taking the whole family, including Brian, on vacation. Just gonna pack up our bags and go. To hell with everything.
Very romantic, Pat said.
She seems quite excited about it.
I know I am.
Jamie didn't say a word. He simply gripped the phone tighter and listened.
Don't you get it yet? Sport. Patricia loves me. She's always loved me. I do know how to make her happy, O'Donnell. I am just her kind. So take care of this person, okay? We both know that getting dirty is your line of work, not mine.
Harper hung up, but Jamie whispered into the phone anyway.
Yes, she's always loved you. But you've never cared, old sport. You got the goddamn perfect family, and you've never, ever cared.
He slammed down the phone, and then he simply felt tired. 4 a.m. A 1-minute roundup of local news came on. Jamie watched the report of a shooting in a downtown hotel. Reporter Larry Digger was dead. Jamie froze. Harper had not mentioned it. Jamie certainly hadn't arranged it. What was going on? He turned up the volume. The gunman had escaped and was being considered armed and dangerous. A sketch flashed on the screen and Jamie recognized the face. He hurled the remote across the room and watched it smash into pieces. It wasn't enough. He tipped over the glass coffee table and listened to it shatter.
You fucker! You panic, shitless, spineless fucker! How dare you betray me like that? How dare you betray me!
The bedroom door opened, and Margaret stood there wearing a white bedsheet and looking at him in confusion.
Jamie?
Go to bed.
And Margaret didn't move. Jamie, what's wrong?
Get away, just get away.
And Margaret moved closer. Then she said calmly,
Nonsense, Jamie. There is nothing you can do that I can't handle. I love you, sweetheart, I do.
Jamie hung his head and groaned. He knew he shouldn't. He did it anyway, crossing to her in 3 strides, his chest thundering, his body covered in sweat. He took her in his arms, and he was at once awed and humbled. This woman had her own kind of beauty and her own kind of strength. This woman had an indomitable spirit and a tough, sensible shell. No pedigrees, no fancy words, no phony pretenses. She was right. Whatever he did, she could handle. Neither of them was better than the other, and neither of them was worse. And he loved her for that. He loved her deeply, and it was one of the few things in life that scared him. Jamie pulled out of her arms. There were things he had to do, and they were errands best done in the dark. The TV was still on, casting its ghostly light on the room. He'd left the canning jar out in the open without thinking, and Margaret suddenly spotted it.
Jamie,
she whispered. He closed his eyes.
It came today,
he said gruffly.
Someone's sick idea of a joke, I guess.
It's about her, isn't it?
Annie, it was a long time ago.
But not long enough, Jamie. Not so long ago that someone still isn't remembering. That someone still doesn't want to see you pay. Jamie couldn't reply to that. Do you still love her?
No, Annie, I don't.
Did she get an adulterer's penis? Maybe a chastity belt? Jamie took her arm, forcing her to look at him.
Annie,
he said softly.
It's not just about Patricia.
How do you know? What is going on?
Harper got a note,
he said steadfastly. What kind of note?
The kind that says you get what you deserve. Plus Larry Digger's in town and Melanie is having migraines and Annie. William got... He got a note too. You get what you deserve.
Oh, God. Her tough, sensible shell shattered.
Why doesn't it ever end? I don't know. Must just be the way of things, I suppose. Some people get a good life and some people don't.
Jamie strapped on his gun.
Don't let anyone in, Annie. And don't answer the phone.
Where are you going? What are you going to do?
I don't know yet.
Jamie. He walked to the door, opened it, took a step, turned again. He came as close as he could to saying what was in his heart.
I'll look after you, Annie. You and Melanie. I swear it.
Brian Stokes jerked awake. It was the fifth time in 5 hours, and his lover finally said,
Do you want to talk about it? Or should I just get you a package of razor blades? Leave me alone. You were dreaming, you know? I heard you call a name.
Brian rolled away.
Shut up.
Nate sat up instead. Besides Melanie, he was the only person Brian had ever trusted. He always pressed, and he always saw too much. Now he tossed back the covers and adjusted his pajamas over his middle-aged frame. A sure sign he was gearing up for a serious discussion.
You called out for Megan,
he said gently.
Brian. Even when you're awake, you never say that name.
Brian thought he was going to cry.
Fuck you.
He got up, walked to the window, and stared out at the still-sleeping city. But the images in his head were all he saw. The funeral on the gray, dreary day. His mother keeling over halfway through the service from grief and gin. His father, stony-faced, looking at her as if he hated her. The silence in the days afterward. The huge house empty of little girl squeals. Harper screaming one night,
Where the hell were you all day? If you'd just come home.
His mother replying,
I didn't know. I thought Brian needed some time alone with me. You know how he can be, especially around her.
Well, he's got you all to himself now, doesn't he? He's got that all fucking right.
I'm sorry. I can't even tell you why I was so cruel. Nate came up behind him.
You're worried about your sister, aren't you?
He asked, rubbing Brian's arms.
You've been like this ever since you went to see her. I don't want to talk about it.
Of course not,
Nate agreed amiably.
So how long are you going to hate yourself, Brian? And how long are you going to hate Melanie for daring to care?
I don't.
She came to you for help. You haven't even called her since.
You don't understand.
Nate gave him a look. He'd seen Brian at his worst, when he was so filled with self-loathing he could barely crawl out of bed. Nate understood plenty. He said,
Then explain it to me.
Give me one logical reason for blowing off your poor sister.
Brian shifted uneasily.
She's better off without me, she is.
Huh, Nate said. Your sister adores you. First sign of trouble, who does she call? Big Brother Brian. That's because she knows you care. Because you've always looked out for her. She trusts you. She loves you. Why are you being so difficult now?
Brian gritted his teeth.
It's different. Your sister needs help. Not that different. It's complicated, all right? She doesn't know about Megan. No one knows about Megan. Damn it, I don't want to know about Megan.
Nate said quietly.
You know, you're the only person I know who came out of the closet to hide a bigger secret.
I did not.
I've been around the block a few times. I know the signs. I've watched other men come out of the closet, and it isn't easy. But generally, there is a moment of relief afterward. You haven't gotten that sense of relief, have you, Brian? 6 months later, you are just as tense and troubled as before. Why is that? If you are finally at peace with who you are, why are you somehow angrier?
Brian couldn't answer. Nate didn't need him to.
Because that wasn't the secret, was it, Brian?
Brian didn't answer. 5 a.m. Dawn was just breaking over the horizon, washing Boston streets in shades of gold. The man finally turned away from the window. He was tired from a long, hard night, but also exhilarated. The game was in full motion now. The players not just assembled, but moving around the board. He found it interesting that for a group of people who half hated one another, for 25 years they had stayed close together. It made it easy to monitor them. Harper was looking over his shoulder. William was carrying a gun. Brian Stokes was suffering from long, sleepless nights. The rest of them were working frantically to keep their secrets. A shooter had been unleashed and the first death recorded. And Melanie? He wasn't even sure where she was, but assumed she was safe. Otherwise, he would have heard. Melanie was the king. She was the prize in the game. The one reason it all unfolded, and the only thing he had to gain. Come on, Melanie. It's all up to you now. Time to remember, sweetheart. Time to put the pieces together. Time to come home to Daddy. Time to come home to me.
19.
All right, Larimore said crisply. What the hell is going on?
At 7 a.m. sharp, there was no messing with the supervisory agent. His double-breasted gray suit was impeccably tailored, his white dress shirt sharply pressed, and his military-cropped hair perfectly even. He sat behind his oversized walnut desk, while behind him the blue FBI seal provided a halo of 13 stars and a white banner declaring fidelity, bravery, and integrity. Even during internal meetings, there was always the feeling that Larimore was conducting a press conference. Still, David liked him. At nearly 50 years of age, the head of the Boston Healthcare Fraud Squad could tell you what every color and object in the FBI shield symbolized. He'd also go to his grave swearing that Hoover never so much as touched a pair of women's underwear. It was all a horrible misunderstanding. He was conservative, he was bureaucratic, but he also believed that healthcare fraud was the worst crime epidemic sweeping the United States since organized crime. 10 cents of every dollar wasted, not to mention shoddy treatment, unnecessary procedures, and the risk of human life. And he worked his ass off to do something about it. A man who believed in his job. In David's mind, a rarity these days. Now Larimore stared down two agents who hadn't slept a wink.
Oh, for heaven's sake,
he finally exclaimed.
Couldn't you two at least have showered and shaved? This isn't a bachelor party.
David and Chaney looked at each other. They shook their heads.
Watching Sheffield,
Chaney mumbled, his eyes lit up.
Got a big break.
Researched Megan Stokes,
David said.
Dodged bullets, talked to Supervisory Special Agent Quincy. No breaks.
You talked to Quincy? At Quantico?
Yeah. Late last night. He's always at the office, too. What the hell is it with this job?
Chaney gazed at David with awe.
Cool. Nah, Jesus, Mary and Joseph.
Larimore stood up from his chair.
In the hallway now.
He stormed out, They followed. He plugged the coffee machine with quarters, then handed them the steaming cups that came shooting out. They accepted, then chugged. Then dutifully followed their disgruntled leader back to his office, where David received a personal lecture on overextending his case team and fracturing a very important, if not critical, investigation. David nursed the rest of his coffee and pulled his thoughts together so he could sound intelligent when he had the chance. It came sooner than he desired.
Let's start with the Megan Stokes case.
Larmore slapped the Harper Stokes, William Sheffield, healthcare fraud case file on the desk.
How the hell did you end up working on a 25-year-old solved homicide?
David started at the beginning and ended by stating his growing certainty that the whole Stokes family had bigger secrets than fraud. Larmore half agreed.
Most perpetrators do have a pattern of small-time fraud in their backgrounds. Maybe they cheated on auto insurance, then graduated to doctoring pharmaceutical billings. But in all my days, Agent, I have never heard of a person starting with conspiring to murder his own child for the insurance money and then trading down for white-collar fraud.
David smiled wearily.
And we don't even know if Harper Stokes is committing healthcare fraud, let alone if he had anything to do with Megan. Personally, Quincy favors the mother.
Harper's doing it,
Cheney burst in.
I got it. I got Sheffield.
Cheney explained his previous night's adventure in one long adrenaline rush. Harry Bower suffered chest pains and was rushed to the ER. By evening, he was in ICU, under sedation but appearing to be fine. Then bam, he had two bradycardic episodes within 5 hours and was now undergoing an operation for a pacemaker performed by none other than Dr. Harper Stokes. And William Sheffield just happened to be spotted in the ICU ward several times, hours after his shift ended, with no patients in that ward. He was just around. Conveniently around, if you asked Cheney.
I called a pharmacist friend first thing this morning,
Cheney announced.
She said that if you wanted to make it appear that someone needed a pacemaker, there are two drugs that would effectively interfere with the electrical conduction of the heart. They are propranolol and digoxin. Propranolol's a beta blocker. It's used to slow a racing heartbeat. Digoxin can also slow down the ventricles, but it might also accelerate the heart to lethal rates. Kind of risky, she said. Most likely Sheffield's using propranolol. So,
Cheney concluded with a flourish,
Sheffield sneaks into the ICU wards at night. That's why he's at the hospital so much. Injecting propranolol just once would cause concern, but probably not lead to a cardiologist immediately recommending surgery. However, if a couple episodes happened right in a row, then the patients appear to have a circulatory disorder and need surgery,
David said.
Brilliantly simple, Larmore said. Must take Sheffield 2 minutes for each injection. Then they're all set for an hour-long procedure that garners Harper $2,000 for the surgery and another $4,000 in royalty dollars as he uses his own custom-designed pacemakers. If they do a couple a week,
Sheffield has no problem paying off his gambling debts, and Harper can spend all he wants.
David sighed.
One thing we are learning about Harper Stokes. He likes a nice lifestyle.
Larmore was nodding thoughtfully. Cheney had resumed looking troubled.
But even if we can now prove Harper Stokes is making money from illegal surgeries, how does that tie in with what happened to Megan Stokes 25 years ago?
That's what I want to know.
David leaned forward, planted his elbows on his knees, and though he was dog-tired from a night spent poring over documents and weathering aching muscles, he got into it.
I went through the entire Houston PD case file last night, and a few key findings about the Megan Stokes case emerged. One, in 1972, the Stokeses were in dire financial straits. They lived in a big house, but it was a gift from Patricia's father, not anything Harper could afford. He was just a resident, barely making $10,000 a year and scrounging to maintain the lifestyle to which his wife was accustomed. He'd taken out a second mortgage on the home and was already behind three payments when Megan disappeared. Bottom line is that from a financial point of view, Megan's murder was the best thing that ever happened to Harper and Patricia Stokes.
So we have motive,
Larmore said. Cheney was not convinced.
If it was only about money, couldn't Harper have dreamed up his little operations back then?
No. Residents are salaried, not paid by the procedure. One pacemaker surgery a week or a dozen, it would have been the same to him.
Now Larmore was the one with an objection.
Still, Dr. Stokes could have done other things, sold drugs from the hospital, sought kickbacks from pharmaceutical representatives. We all know there are many ways for healthcare providers at any level to abuse their positions for money. So I believe Chaney's point still stands. We have established that Harper and Patricia Stokes needed the money, but you haven't convinced me yet that they are the type of people to cold-bloodedly murder their little girl to get it. All right. Fair enough. That brings me to my second key finding. Not only did Harper have motive, but just about everyone in the family was having problems back then. To hell with having one suspect. In 1972, the police had four. Harper Stokes, Patricia Stokes, Jamie O'Donnell, and believe it or not, Brian Stokes.
David nodded at their startled expressions.
Exactly. This family doesn't just have skeletons, it has graveyards. So if you don't like Harper for the murder, let's look at everyone else. Patricia Stokes. Long before she met Harper, she was rich. Born into oil wealth, raised by a fairly domineering father and the apple of his eye. Doesn't sound like her father liked Harper much. Thought he wasn't good enough for his daughter. But that didn't stop him from giving his little girl a dream wedding and a mansion up on the hill. Unfortunately, when Patricia settled down to a future as a doctor's wife, she discovered she didn't like the scenery. Even before Brian was out of diapers, she was acting restless and bored. She took to spending lots of money, went out partying, and she started spending more time with Jamie O'Donnell than with her husband. Though her husband seemed to be spending more time with 20-something nurses than his own wife. According to friends of the family, they did make an attempt at reconciliation. Harper started coming home more often, and they made a decision to have a second child, Megan. This time it seemed to work. With two kids at home, Patricia gave up the party scene and finally settled into motherhood. She took up charity work, joined a few organizations, but mostly appeared content to dote on her children. According to the housekeeper, she and Harper shared a bedroom again. But the housekeeper never had to change the sheets, if you get my drift. A lot of marriages turn into that,
Larimore said mildly.
If that's a sign of criminal activity, we'd have to arrest all husbands and wives married more than 5 years.
David smiled.
Sure, but we're not done with the Stokeses yet. So now we have Megan Stokes in the picture. We got Harper and Patricia and the two children and happily ever after. But then, 6 months before Megan's murder, Patricia and Harper start fighting every night. One maid apparently said something to friends of the family, and Patricia fired her the next day. And wonder of all wonders, Jamie O'Donnell starts hanging around again. He and Patricia have a thing?
Chaney said.
Seems that way. Police couldn't prove it, but you can't believe he's hanging around the house for the cooking. And Patricia is already starting to hit the gin. Everyone says it was the murder of Megan that sent her over the brink, but the police can trace it back to before Megan's death. Right before. Which means whatever was going on, it had put Patricia in a questionable state of mind. Who knows what women do in a questionable state of mind?
Larimore nodded slowly, pursing his lips.
Interesting. So we have a materialistic workaholic doctor, an unhappy alcoholic wife, and a love triangle with the family friend. Exactly what is Jamie O'Donnell's connection with the Stokeses? Old friend of Harper's from college days. Not that O'Donnell went to school. He's strictly self-educated and self-made. Started out working in the oil fields and took it from there. On the surface, he and Harper make an unlikely pair. But they're both driven. Of course, they took entirely different routes to the top. Harper is now Mr. Community and Mr. Family, whereas Jamie O'Donnell knows people. Interpol has a file on the man.
What?
Now he had Larimore's attention. David waved it away.
Interpol has been desperate to prove that he runs guns, but has never found a thing other than he keeps interesting company. Otherwise, he runs a legitimate import business, pays his taxes every April 15th, and puts his pants on one leg at a time just like the rest of us. The rest of us aren't sleeping with Patricia Stokes,
Chaney said dryly. David shrugged.
Sure. So now we have the money motive and the love triangle. Maybe Harper was so angry at his wife he decided killing Megan would be a great way to spite her and solve his financial woes. Or maybe Jamie O'Donnell thought Patricia would never leave Harper as long as they had children together. So he tried to do something about it. Or maybe when Patricia was strung too tightly, had a little too much to drink, Megan chose that moment to act out. And boom. Bye-bye, Megan. Now we come to possibility number three. Brian Stokes. This family just gets better and better, muttered Chaney. Not exactly the Waltons,
David agreed.
Brian in particular has a very troubled history. According to the Houston police report, he frequently broke items in the house and was known to reduce his mother to tears on almost a nightly basis. The interviewing officer wrote that the nanny had standing orders not to leave Brian alone in a room with Megan. Apparently, he'd gone out of his way to destroy some of her toys. Then, just to make it a slam dunk, Brian was seeing a therapist in 1972. It seems that Brian already had a history of playing with matches. You're kidding me.
Larimore sat up straighter.
Don't tell me he's also a bedwetter and an animal torturer.
Larimore was referring to the violent triad developed by the profilers. For whatever reason, serial killers always had at least two legs of that triangle in their past. But not Brian Stokes.
Just petty arson,
David said.
Now, to make matters even more interesting, he and Patricia have no alibi for the day Megan disappeared. Patricia told the cops that she took Brian to his therapist. The cops confirmed that, but the appointment was over at 10 a.m. The cops got the call from the nanny at 2 p.m. that Megan had disappeared from her car. At 5, Patricia and Brian drove up to the house, where they were both supposedly surprised by the news. What about Harper Stokes or Jamie O'Donnell?
Larimore asked.
Do they have alibis?
David shook his head.
Harper claimed to be at work, but no one could ever vouch for it. O'Donnell said he was out of town, but never produced any proof. Better yet, the police aren't even convinced the nanny was telling the truth about when Megan was taken. She barely spoke English, refused to meet their gaze when answering questions, and spent most of the time sliding closer to Harper. They thought she might be a little involved with him, or at least wanted to make sure he liked what she was saying. In all probability, Megan could have been taken at any time from any place that day. One day, Megan Stokes is simply gone. The next day, the ransom note appears at the hospital where Harper works, and nothing is seen or heard from the kidnapper again. Then 8 weeks later, Megan's body is found by a man and his dog out taking a walk. Quincy is right. Everything about the Megan Stokes case reeks to high heaven, and every single member of the family carries the stench. If Russell Lee Holmes had not confessed, the police would have investigated the Stokeses and O'Donnell until the cows came home. And as long as the investigation was active, the insurance company would not pay out the policy. Basically, Russell Lee's last-minute confession to Larry Digger earned the family the end of a very embarrassing investigation and $1 million. How convenient, then, Larimore murmured, that Russell Lee Holmes confessed.
Exactly, David said. Exactly.
Quincy is going to reopen this case,
Larimore asked.
That's what he said, but I don't think he needs to officially reopen it. We're looking into it as part of our case. No,
Larimore said.
No?
Larimore rewarded his incredulous tone with a stern look.
With all due respect, Agent, you are in healthcare fraud. Agent Cheney here has discovered we have a viable allegation against Dr. Harper Stokes and Dr. William Sheffield if we can prove their activities. That case is your job. That case needs your focus.
But the shooter, Larry Digger,
will be investigated by the Boston PD since it falls in their jurisdiction, just as the Megan Stokes case is in very capable hands with Quincy.
God damn it!
David bolted out of his chair, staring at his supervisor incredulously.
This is my case. I've worked my ass off connecting these dots. I got a terrified woman in a hotel room who doesn't even know if it's safe to go home to her family, and I got a direct link with the case I'm already working.
You do not have a link,
Larimore fired back. He gave David a warning look. David didn't take it.
The hell I don't! 25 years ago, the Stokeses needed money, and their daughter died, providing them with $1 million. Now Harper is once more living beyond his means, and he's come up with another way of getting money, cutting open innocent people for profit. It's a pattern of behavior.
Now even Cheney was looking at him as if he'd lost his mind.
There's no pattern. Murdering your kid is not remotely close to installing illegal pacemakers. One is insurance fraud, one is healthcare fraud. One is homicide. The other is criminal, sure, but an unnecessary pacemaker isn't even dangerous. The pacemaker would be activated only if the person had a heart attack. Someone could seize up and die on the table. Reckless endangerment of human life. Which is still a far cry from murdering your own kid.
The rookie is right, Larimore said. You have established motive, Agent Riggs, but you haven't established character. We know Harper Stokes likes his lifestyle maybe enough to commit fraud, But what evidence do we have that he would commit murder? Does he have a history of violence?
No.
Child abuse, spousal abuse, and neglect?
No.
By all accounts, he's raised 2 healthy children. No trips to emergency rooms, no arguments reported by neighbors. And in your first report on Harper Stokes, didn't you write that he has a reputation for being a doting father and being exceedingly generous with his wife?
David gritted his teeth.
Yes. And Patricia Stokes, I know Quincy has questions about the carefully wrapped body, but again, any history of abuse or neglect?
She has a problem with alcohol,
which resurfaced 6 months ago. Any reports of violence then?
David was forced to shake his head.
Which brings us to Jamie O'Donnell. Maybe we have a criminal past there. According to Larry Digger, he visited the midwife in Texas, but again, by all reports, he dotes on his godchildren and is close to the family. That just leaves us with Brian Stokes,
Larimore continued.
But by your own admission, he adores his second sister and has always been extremely protective of her. Face it, Agent. This case is over your head. The motives are there and opportunity is there, but none of the players make sense. At least not to our eyes. So leave it to the experts. Leave it to Quincy.
They are connected,
David said stiffly.
And I'll tell you one last reason why.
Larimore and Chaney looked impatient for his little display to end.
The caller,
David stated.
The anonymous tipster who alerted us to the healthcare fraud at the same time he was alerting Larry Digger to Melanie. His agenda seems to be revenge for Megan Stokes, for making sure everyone gets what they deserve. So if he's bringing us in on it, they're related. They're all related.
Larimore remained skeptical, but finally he sighed.
All right, Agent. I'll give you one last shot. Establish character. Bring me any proof that Harper, Patricia, or Brian Stokes is cruel enough or cold enough or clinically unstable enough to engineer the death of 4-year-old Megan Stokes, and I'll let you work on it in your own time. Right now, I believe that healthcare fraud is the only viable case my agents have.
Fine,
David said curtly. Since Larimore didn't want to hear anything more about 25-year-old homicides, they focused on the fraud angle that Chaney had uncovered. They had no hard physical evidence, so their options were limited. They could prove motive, money, and opportunity, but they needed physical evidence or a good eyewitness account. Eyewitnesses, unfortunately, were notoriously hard to get in a hospital setting. There were too many nurses and doctors around for most patients to keep straight, and nurses and doctors had a code of silence. They did not rat each other out even when they saw evidence of a crime. The consensus was to put Chaney in the hospital undercover as a janitor. He'd prowl the ICU, ask the nurses questions, maybe even catch Sheffield in the act. David was given the fun-filled act of building the paper trail, going over the financial statements to prove need, looking for evidence of payoffs between Harper and Sheffield. Then he turned his attention to Melanie Stokes, where he began his work in earnest. But by the end of the day, he had merely proven Larimore's point. Except for the migraines, Melanie was in perfect health. Not a single broken bone, not a single unexplained bruise. She was reported as happy and well-adjusted, the recipient of the best birthday parties on the block. By all accounts, her entire family simply loved her to death. 20. Melanie woke up Tuesday morning thinking of Megan, of the family she loved so much and had assumed loved her. She got up to stand in front of the dresser and stared at her reflection. Damn it, she did not look like Megan. She was not nearly as beautiful. She slapped the top of the dresser, then stormed downstairs. David wasn't around, but he'd left a note on the kitchen table. Went to meeting. We'll be back after 5. Remember, no going outdoors. D. She set down the note and roamed the room. She found frozen vegetables in the freezer and a jar of instant coffee on the counter. She boiled water to give herself something to do. While it heated up, she unburied her day timer from her purse and looked up her schedule. The books were way overdue to the rare book dealer. She'd planned lunch with an old friend from Wellesley, followed by an afternoon meeting with the committee for the Children's Hospital Winter Ball. It was already nearly June and they had yet to line up entertainment. The whole thing was a disaster waiting to happen. Melanie got on the phone and canceled everything. She had the flu, she said. Everyone was sympathetic. They encouraged her to rest. Of course, they could manage without her. She hung up, feeling disappointed. She'd wanted dismay, she realized finally. Cries of, "We need you, Melanie. We'll never make it without you." "You're special, Melanie. Indispensable. You are not a substitute daughter." Damn it. How could her mother say she'd wanted Megan again? How could she have looked at Melanie and seen Megan? Was it always just about Megan? Did they all feel that way? Her mother, her father, her brother, her godfather. The people who had taken her in and given her a home. The people she trusted and considered her own family. Melanie thought, to hell with questions. She was going to figure out the answers. On a pad of paper, she drew a circle and labeled it Megan. Then around it, she drew circles for her mother, her father, her brother, and Jamie. Then she drew in Russell Lee Holmes, Larry Digger, and herself. Finally, she added Anne Margaret. David seemed to feel she was involved, and at this point, Melanie shouldn't exclude any possibilities. Considering that, she also drew in William Sheffield. 9 different people, all surrounding one little girl. She drew lines connecting Megan to her mother, father, brother, and godfather. It actually bothered her, like acknowledging another woman in a lover's life. But it was true. Megan had come first. Melanie added Larry Digger's relationship as journalist. She could not come up with any direct lines for William Sheffield or Anne Margaret. Russell Lee Holmes was even more troubling. She wanted to write killer, but Quincy had raised too much doubt. Russell Lee was connected not directly to Megan then, but to the other people encircling Megan. And after a moment's hesitation, she drew a line between Russell Lee Holmes and herself. Father and daughter, there in black and white. After that, she found that the rest flowed easier. A little after 5:30, David rapped on the door 3 times and entered. He was holding a paper bag. From the couch, Melanie arched a brow inquiringly.
"Raw Chinese,"
David said at last. He held out the bag, trying to gauge her mood. "Fine," she agreed. He edged into the kitchen.
"Spicy orange beef and General Tso's chicken."
"Nice." Despite David's fear, she was not angry with him. She'd spent the day with her diagram, and it had given her what she needed most. Conclusive proof that her family could not have killed Megan Stokes. It made Melanie happy. She climbed off the sofa and followed David into the kitchen. David's jacket was off, his green paisley tie loosened, and his white shirt sleeves rolled up to his elbows. He was getting to the point of needing a haircut. His hair held track marks from his fingers running through it 1 too many times, and those lines were back at the corners of his eyes. He looked like he'd had a very bad day. And for a moment, Melanie was tempted to cup his cheek with her hand. She wondered if he would turn his face into her touch. She wondered if he would move closer. She had liked the way he'd held her last night. He said,
"The bowls are in the cupboard."
She got them down and they dished up their dinner. They ate in silence for nearly half the meal before David spoke up.
"How was your day?"
"I watched Jerry Springer." "Enough said." "And yours?" He dug deeper into his fried rice.
"I would have preferred Jerry Springer. Did you sleep at all last night?"
"A little."
"Any more dreams of Megan?"
"A blend. Megan Stokes in that cabin, but you were there too." He glanced at her in surprise. A grain of rice decorated his bottom lip, and without thinking, she brushed it away with her thumb. The motion caught them both off guard, and she quickly pulled her hand back.
I was in the cabin with you and Megan Stokes," she said a trifle breathlessly.
"Me?"
He sounded frazzled himself and was studying his bowl intently.
"What was I doing there?"
"House cleaning."
"What?"
Melanie took another bite of food. Megan Stokes was in the corner of the cabin, clutching her horse and very, very afraid. "Then you walked into the cabin and started cleaning. Swept the floors, removed the cobwebs, cleaned the windows. Oh, and you hung drapes."
"I hung drapes."
David looked stricken.
"So much for to serve and protect."
"They were very nice drapes," Melanie said. Megan was happy.
Housekeeper extraordinaire,
he muttered, pushing his empty bowl away.
Give me a cape and I'll call it a day.
He sighed, and it hurt her to see the weariness on his face.
Well,
he said seriously,
do you want to know what I learned today?
She pushed back her bowl and squared her shoulders. Sure. Give it to me straight. What did you learn?
Nothing,
David said bluntly.
The great FBI agent learned nothing. This whole case simply makes no sense.
He stood and began to clear the table. The shooter?
Jack said they checked with area hospitals and locals. So far, no sign.
Any more evidence from Larry Digger's room? The notes?
Nope, not a thing.
David walked into the kitchen, slammed the bowls into the sink. What about Megan's case? Did you talk more about it?
Sure. I reviewed it with my supervisor and Cheney. We all agree that